south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander...
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
How about today, a couple of surprising boots-on-the-ground stories? People seem to prefer those over me reading dry articles, even if there's a high body count. Yep, I get emails all the time from you requesting more boots-on-the-ground stories. And yep, I get requests for new Expat Eddie stories, too. Yeah, I got one coming at you pretty soon. It's kind of sad, too. You take the good with the bad, right? That's life. I'll start by saying I'm so happy Latin America's not woke at all, and there's lots and lots of evidence for it. For example, all the big commercial centers and public spaces have handicapped parking spots. You could predict that, right? Spots for pregnant women and old geezers, too. Well, you know what the common term for a handicapped person is here in Latin America? It's menos válido. That means you see signs in commercial spots and chicken buses and such that say, this seat or these seats or these spots are reserved for menos válidos. Sometimes they lump in all three. Geezers, menos válidos, and pregnant ladies. Oh, and down here they don't believe men can get pregnant. There's a revolutionary concept, huh? But get this, the direct translation for menos válido is less valid person. You heard that right, a person who's less valid. Menos means minus or less, and válido means valid. Now, if that's not a phrase that's completely un-PC, I don't know what is. Though, there does seem to be a small movement trying to get away from that term. Though, you still do hear people say it all the time. Not in a derogatory way either, it's just a word that's been around in Spanish for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's the educated Latinos who are bilingual who know the English translation, and it kind of makes them wince. So, in the end, there really is a problem with that term. But it keeps getting used. Though I understand newscasters and the media, like journalists in the paper, don't use it anymore. They've slowly phased it out. But I bet they still use it at home. But man, could you imagine up in the States if you saw a sign in a parking lot that said, this spot reserved for old people, pregnant ladies, and people of less value? So the truth is, forever and a day, down here in Latin America, handicapped persons by that term alone are considered less valuable. I know, it's not good, it's got to change. Though I wouldn't say it has anything to do with Latin America suddenly going woke. It's got nothing to do with that. It's just not right, it's demeaning. By the way, the other day I was at a restaurant, and there was a table next to me, a table of Latinos, and they were arguing about the bill. I was kind of on the gringo tourist trail, and what I hate about restaurants and hotels and bed and breakfasts on the gringo tourist trail, no matter where you are in Latin America, they've got two different added costs on your bill. One is the tips included, which is kind of normal down here, could be 10 to 15%. But the real aggravating add-on is the tourist tax, which could be 10 to 20%, no matter where you are. But again, you'll only find that on the gringo tourist trail. Once you get out a ways, it suddenly disappears. So that is really one way to tell if you're on the gringo tourist trail. As if you couldn't figure that out already from all the overweight white guys in cargo pants. Bottom line though, if there's a tourist or tourist tax on your restaurant bill, you're definitely smack dab on the tourist trail. Which in fact instantly turns a $10 restaurant bill into a bill that's 13 bucks or more. But actually it gets worse, and that's what really pisses me off. Because, you know, in the original bill, they've already added the IVA or VAT tax in, and in most Latin American countries, it doesn't show up on the bill at all. It's just added right in, like in, for example, Guatemala. At least it's hidden, so you don't have to get pissed every time you look at the bill. It's just buried in there somewhere. That includes going to the appliance or hardware store, too. That VAT or IVA, they call it, is included right in the bill, so at least you're not reminded of that gouge every time you get a receipt. The receipt's called a factura down here, by the way. So, if you're on the gringo tourist trail, here's how it breaks down, and it will piss you off. Your final bill includes the cost of the food, that would be the price on the menu, right? 10% on top of that for service, 15% let's say for the tourism tax, and 12% IVA, or value-added tax. So, over and above the price that's printed on the menu, you're hit with another 33% or more. Yet another reason to stay as far off the gringo tourist trail as you can. Meanwhile, back at the restaurant, at the table right next to me, I could hear everything, too. They were arguing about the bill. I heard the lady at the table, now remember, they're speaking Spanish exclusively, they're Latinos, saying that the service was terrible and that they shouldn't pay the propina, the tip. Of course, it was already included in the bill. So to not pay it would cause a kind of a ruckus because then the manager would have to come over, agree to, and make the change, which would not be easy due to the fact that the factura is printed and it's in the system in the computer. So if someone doesn't pay that amount, at the end of the day, when they do their tabulations, someone would have to pony up that 10 or 12%. It would have been the waitress or waiter. If not, the books wouldn't balance. Believe me, over the years, I've been at many a restaurant here in Latin America where a gringo or gringa would say, the service was bad or the food sucked, so I'm not going to leave a tip. And usually I'm talking about fresh green gringos or tourists who haven't been down here before or not for very long. And I always advise them, let's just pay it and get out of here and never come back again. Because if you short them on the tip, we're going to spend the next 15 or 20 minutes arguing with the manager. Oh, you'll get your way all right. But everybody in the restaurant will be staring at you because that almost never happens. Almost no one, no locals anyway, ever argue about a tip. Except gringos and expats. Latinos never seem to gripe. That's why it was so unusual seeing the table next to me make a stink about it. And you know, having a tip included on a check irks me. You see it now in almost all restaurants here in Latin America, except the tiny mom and pop joints out in the boonies. Every other establishment will add it to the bill and it's computerized, so it's in the system. Anyway, the waiter came back to collect the bill and said, was everything okay? You know, you get that usual spiel from waiters and waitresses all the time. That's a common refrain, and even if something was rotten or wrong, you usually say, yeah, it was okay. Just kind of a formality, like saying, have a nice day. You might call it social lubrication. But in this case, the lady spoke up and laid into the guy. But I have to admit, you know, I was pretty close to that table. I could tell those two were fighting, the guy and the lady. Sound like she drank a little too much, lover spat and all that. So she was all on edge and ready to pounce on anyone. In this case, it just happened to be the waiter. Man, she had her claws out. I'm glad I wasn't on the receiving end. Hey, you know, it's not the waiter's fault if the food was prepared badly. Though, I picked up on the fact that the center of her chicken was not fully cooked. It was raw. Man, that is nasty. She had to send it back two times. And those Latinas, man, when they get pissed off, talk about spontaneous combustion. And you know, it is a really rare thing that Latinos complain about anything in a restaurant or send anything back. But, you know, uncooked chicken, man, that's got to go back. Whereas gringos and expats, man, especially newbie, green gringos and expats and vacationers, they can hassle the crap out of a waiter. And the waiter, who sometimes speaks very little English, and the customers almost zero Spanish, he or she is flummoxed and does not know what to do. Anyway, it seemed to me in all my years down here, that's the first time I ever saw a Latino stiff a waiter on a tip. And yes, the manager came over and all that. Voices were raised and everyone in the restaurant was staring. But here's the thing, as they got up to leave, the manager and the waiter both made an about face, turned to the kitchen where no one could see him. Well, I saw him, but not the people who stiffed him, the ones that were on their way up. Both the manager and the waiter held up their left arms and quickly touched their elbows with the palm of their right hands, which is the universal signal here in Latin America for cheapskate or tacaño. Tacaño means cheapskate. So just know if you ever see anyone do that, and it's done once in a while, you'll see it. They don't have to say the words. They almost never do. They just raise the arm, hit the elbow, and that means cheapskate, tacaño. Everyone down here knows what it means. In fact, if you're in one of those cheap Chinese restaurants, they're everywhere down here, you'll see occasional backpackers hanging out. They've got a nose for the cheapest places in town. I mean, that's the backpacker lifestyle, right? Well, that's why waiters and waitresses in general dislike backpackers and, for that matter, European tourists, because they're bad tippers, notorious cheapskates, tacaños. Then, of course, we've got the German tourists who are in a tacaño class all their own. Oh, but we mustn't forget, American school teachers are in that category, too. They generally travel cheap, very budget, though not as cheap as backpackers. But, you know, teachers are notoriously underpaid, and they get that 3 months off every year, so a lot of them take to traveling. Good for them, but they've got that tight-wad reputation, too. In a way, you can hardly blame them. They don't make much dough and can't afford to be big tippers. Though, I've seen this myself. They've got a bad habit of going into a restaurant and telling the waiter to make it one big bill. Then they spend about an hour haggling and pulling out the calculators, check every item ordered against the menu, and cipher things down to the penny. And I noticed there always seems to be one extra tightwad teacher who skips off to the bathroom when the tip is being calculated. And then people throw money into the pot, someone tallies it. There's always enough for the food money, but the tip often comes up short. I've seen it myself. My family's full of teachers. And if there's one or two people in the group who aren't teachers, They'll pony up the extra to avoid appearing like a teacher. And that person was often me because way back when in Chicago, I had a girlfriend who was an art teacher. I got dragged to a lot of those events and was a good observer. Which begs the question, are you a tacaño? By the way, do you want to know what I'm so sick of? No, you probably don't. Well, I'm going to tell you anyway. I'm so sick of teachers bitching about how little money they make. Listen, Buster, you chose that career everybody knows day one. When you first sign up for those liberal arts and education classes, you know the pay basically sucks. So then why did you choose it if you're going to endlessly bitch about it? But you did. So shut up about it. You could have become a chemist, a programmer, an engineer, a doctor, dentist, whatever. Or maybe not. You felt like partying your way through college, which is what liberal arts students do, right? Not math, engineering, or medical types. They can't afford to party, or they'll flunk out. And if you regret being a teacher, you should have thought about that a long time ago when you chose partying and socializing over studying. Man, I'll tell you, when I was in engineering school, no one had a real social life. Sure, you went out on weekends, but weekdays you just could not do it, or you'd flunk out. End of story. Punto final, as they say in Espanol. There are 1,001 careers to choose from that pay more than a teacher. You chose teaching, or maybe that was your fallback position. Quit whining about it. By the way, I've met a lot of teachers here in Latin America. I'm not talking about gringos teaching down here. Latinos teaching. They never complain that they get shitty salaries. Oh, they get crap pay all right, but they don't whine about it. All right, moving on. You longtime listeners have heard me say how I've built 12 or 13 different houses or buildings. Well, now I think it's time to tell you about the two biggest mistakes or disasters I made in or while building those things. Hey, you can't win them all. So with two out of those 12 or 13, I've had some big regrets. I think you really ought to know about these two disasters so you don't let it happen to you. Though I have to say one of those disasters didn't critically or toxically damage the final product. By the way, almost all of those places I did build and live in and did sell because you move on, you know. And I have to say I never built a place expecting some big return. I did it because I wanted to live in it or because I needed it for a business, whatever. I really never made money on real estate. I broke even, but I never made money, which I guess is all you can hope to expect. At least I built those places to have really good views and nice gardens and all that. So I always had a nice place. And when I got up in the morning and looked out the window, I was happy to be there. Plus, I got free rent. What more can you ask, right? So anyway, the first construction disaster was something that I couldn't have anticipated, so it wasn't my fault. And the second disaster was something totally out of the ordinary, something I could never have predicted in a million years. But now I know it's always a possibility. So first, let's talk about the more routine disaster. You see, I built this big, beautiful house out in the boonies. Nice big garden, fruit trees everywhere. The house was beautiful and so well made. Beautiful rainforest hardwood doors and hardwood trim. And beautiful imported Spanish tiles everywhere on all the floors. And that's when I noticed the problem. After living there about 2 years, I sort of noticed some white crystals effervescing between the grout joints and some of the tiles. I'm thinking, this isn't right. What's happening here? Though it was easy to brush the stuff right off, and then you'd be down to the dark grout again. Didn't seem like anything big or to worry about at the time. It was just happening in a couple of little spaces around the edges, the corners. But then in time, the problem got worse. I started to see those white crystals show up on the floor tiles in the first floor bathrooms. Now, it only appeared in the first floor, so obviously it had something to do with water percolation. Now, these dry crystals were not wet or moist in any way. But it was definitely a chemical reaction between the cement layer below the tile and the grout and water or moisture somehow working its way up to the surface and reacting. So I did all kinds of searches on the internet, trying to figure out what to do, how to combat that stuff. And I kept thinking about other Latin American houses I've seen who've got the same problem. It seems to be ubiquitous when you've got tile floors. I don't think I've been in a Latin American house that's over 10 or so years old that doesn't have a bit of the same problem. Crystals forming in the grout joints on the first floor tile. And I was thinking, you know, that's why you put a vapor barrier down before you pour the concrete. Because I'd say 98% of the houses do not have basements. That way, there's not a chance that water or moisture can percolate up. I know I insisted on that. I saw when the guys were putting it down. Of course, by then, a couple of years had passed and I couldn't locate the contractor. You know, these guys move around a lot and change their phone numbers too, especially when they get a phone stolen. They usually end up popping in a new chip with a new number. So anyway, I went to one of the biggest hardware stores, carry a lot of American products. And I jotted down the number of a company that makes the largest amount of waterproofing products. You see them in all the hardware stores down here. They happen to have a big office in Guatemala. I went down there, made an appointment to talk to one of the engineers. I showed him some of the pictures of the problem on the phone, and he told me exactly what was happening, which I sort of suspected already. He said, if your contractor put down a vapor barrier, he did not use a certified vapor barrier, one that was designed and approved for that purpose. He said, I bet he put down a layer of that black plastic polyethylene film, the stuff that comes in big rolls. I said, yep, that's what he did, all right. So then whose fault was it, mine or the contractor? He put a vapor barrier down, but it turns out it was the kind that slowly deteriorates in the presence of water. So eventually it does break down. Boy, did I learn my lesson. The thing is, even if you rip up the tile, you can't go back in and put a vapor barrier down because the vapor barrier goes below the base of cement that the tile lays on. However, there is a sort of Rube Goldberg solution I ended up using. Turns out when you see those crystals starting to form, and that's just in the grout lines, you can dig out the grout. It's a dirty job, so have your maintenance guy do it. Straight down to the cement base, which generally is about a half inch down, not much. Then you mix up a new batch of the same colored grout. By the way, grout for tile down here is called CISA, C-I-S-A, CISA. Now, obviously, if you put a new mix of grout back in there, in a couple of years, you'll get more of the same, more effervescing crystals. Luckily, that company I was telling you about, I can't think of their name right now. I will. If you want to send me an email, theexpertfiles@gmail.com, I'll look it up and send you the details. They make a lot of really good waterproofing and other construction adhesive products. Oh, I remember the name now. Sika, S-I-K-A. Anyway, Sika makes a liquid that you mix in with the grout, waterproofing it through and through. If you do that, any time you replace the old grout that's had crystals forming on it, the new grout won't let the crystals penetrate, won't let the water or the moisture that causes that chemical reaction percolate up. So basically, that's about the only solution you have, and it does work. But think of all the bullshit you'll have to go through in the future, because those white crystals will pop up elsewhere, all because the contractor decided to cheap out and not buy the recommended vapor barrier, but to put plastic down because it'll work for a while. The thing is, real vapor barrier material costs 3 to 4 times as much as that plastic stuff in a roll. Oh, and by the way, if you look at houses and projects that are being constructed, when they're pouring the concrete in the first floor, they rarely use a vapor barrier at all, even the crappy stuff. Turns out that's something you usually have to insist on yourself. Imagine all the gringos and expats who know absolutely nothing about construction, and they order a house to be built. If you don't alert your contractor, you might not get a vapor barrier at all. I've seen how they do it. They'll just do a first floor cement pour right on a base of gravel or pea gravel or even earth. And that's a recipe for humidity. Of course, the problems won't show up for a couple of years, but by then, the contractor's long gone. Oh, and by the way, when I first started groundbreaking on that house, when the contractor was laying out the footings, you know, with string and stakes, and they pour the footings and start blocking up the walls, well, one day I'd say about a month or a month and a half into the project, it was very early on, I decided to take my big T-square and check out the corners for accuracies, make sure they're 90 degrees exactly. And sure enough, they were off by a couple of degrees. And I thought, hell, if this contractor can't square up a house from the get-go, that means that every room in the house will be off by a few degrees. It'll be sort of like a trapezoid. Not noticeable to the eye, but I, being an engineer in a past life, would sure notice it. Well, I got together with the architect that night, and I told him I wanted a new general foreman, a new contractor, basically, and a new crew. And he said, yeah, I know some guys I can call, but you'll have to stop work at least 2 weeks, maybe three, to get the new guy on board and his crew organized. I said, I don't care. I want it right. And he kind of rolled his eyes, thinking that any Latino in that situation would have said, just cut him some slack and let's keep rolling. Details, details, huh? But I thought, man, a mistake like that right out of the box, something fundamental like that that would affect the entire project, That day, I'd lost all confidence in that general foreman. So we stopped work for like a month. You know how lag time is down here. He said 2 or 3 weeks. Well, that ends up being a month. But in the end, the house came out very nicely, except for that vapor barrier problem I told you about. Man, I'll tell you, when I started seeing those little crystal formations, that was a hard lesson to learn. All right, now for the construction, or I should say remodeling story to end all stories. And I'll tell you, if you've ever heard a story like this before, or it's happened to you, I'll buy you dinner, a night on the town, a bottle of tequila. We'll cry in our drinks and compare notes. All right, so along with building 12 or 13 buildings and houses, I also bought a few apartments and townhouses, that were sort of in disrepair, but had fantastic views or were in great neighborhoods. You know how they say, buy the crappiest house in the neighborhood and fix it up? Well, I did that. It turns out I bought a two-floor penthouse in a high-rise that had the most fantastic ocean views you ever saw. Had the rooftop, two balconies. Views just to die for, except turns out it had been water damaged. And I mean every room had water damage. Every ceiling was stained and moldy. If you walked into the place, it was unlivable. It was a disaster. Except, like I said, it had million, if not billion-dollar views. Now, this is the 7th and 8th floor of a high-rise tower, and everybody below those levels had no water damage or anything at all, because those residential towers, especially the ones made in the last 20 years anyway, in the big cities in Latin America, there's lots of waterproofing between every level. They have to do it that way because of the inundations during the rainy season. So anyway, at the time, I'd say about 4.5 years ago, before the COVIDiot crap, I was looking for a place like that, a place that had fantastic views that you could lock it up and go away for a couple of months, travel, whatever, and come back and all you had to do was bring in the cleaning lady to mop and dust a bit. So anyway, I must have viewed at least 20 different penthouses, put a couple offers too that were rejected. In fact, all I cared about was that it was in a great, safe neighborhood and had fantastic views. I didn't care if the building was fairly new or old, I'd do the remodeling. So anyway, I put in two offers, two fantastic buildings, got them both rejected. Then I found this place. Turns out, it had been on the market for probably a year and a half. And the price just kept dropping like a rock. I think it started out at $300,000, ended up getting it for two. Now remember, it needs probably $100,000 in remodeling. And I saw the listing, it had dropped and dropped and dropped and dropped. Oh, and here's the story. The guy who built the tower about 12 years earlier, the contractor, he reserved the penthouse, the top two floors, for his only daughter, who, by the way, never moved in. She fell out with him, and the place remained unoccupied, pretty much abandoned, for something like 8 years. Unfortunately, they never quite got around to waterproofing the roof. Because remember, here in Latin America, most residential towers have flat roofs. And you got to take a lot of extra precautions to make sure there are no seepage or leaks. That's one of the big problems here in Latin America. Everything leaks. So anyway, the place was unoccupied for years. Then, approximately 5 years ago, some guy bought it. A married Latino guy. Thinking he was going to remodel the whole thing. And guess what? He got a divorce. He cheated on his wife, he told me. And that penthouse got stuck in the middle of a divorce settlement. And you know, sometimes during those divorce things, when they have to sell a place, they put it on the market, get no offers, start dropping the price, still no offers. Then the first offer comes in, they panic sell. So I got the place, and that's when the trouble started. So I got an architect and a builder, and I was going to help do some of the remodeling myself. I can do the electrical and some of the plumbing and stuff. I mean, hey, keep your hand at it when you can, right? So anyway, I got a legit registered architect and a builder registered. They worked up a remodeling proposal that did come in at around $100,000. A really nice detailed proposal too. And I took it to the Junta Directiva. That's, you know, the housing committee, the residence committee. You know, you've got those in all neighborhoods, right? And residential towers. They make the rules, hire the guards and gardeners, collect your monthly maintenance fee, etc., etc. So I submitted the proposal, got it approved, signed and sealed. The time estimate to get all that remodeling construction done was exactly 6 months. During that time, you know, there'll be lots of construction, lots of hammers going, lots of people hauling material up and down the stairs and in the elevators. Jackhammers going, ripping out ceilings and tiles, you know, lots and lots of noise. So anyway, that 6 months passed, and guess what? Lag time. We weren't done. We needed another month, so we pressed on. So a week after that 6 months, the cops came to the door with an injunction, said I had to stop all work on the project. I hired a lawyer. He went to court. We pressed on, continued to work. The cops came again with another injunction, this time with the municipality saying that I didn't get a permit. Like, you really need a permit to remodel your own place. Well, technically, I guess you do, but no one ever gets one. The municipality fined me $1,000. So all in all, it cost me $1,000 there, $1,000 for the lawyer, and untold fury, knowing the people in my own new residential tower hated my guts. My lawyer told me they were just jealous because I had the nicest place on the tower, and I just plowed right in gringo style and did it my way. But you see, the real reason why all that happened is because it was an exclusive neighborhood, and if you looked in the parking lot of that tower, these guys had Range Rovers, Porsches, BMWs, even a Ferrari or two. They were rich old fossils. And in the end, I found out I was the youngest guy in the whole tower. Everyone seemed to be over 70. In other words, I bought a place in a virtual, wealthy old folks home. I mean, all during that time, I never heard any music, no partying. None of the usual Latin American, let's have a good old time on the weekend thing. I'd see these people in the elevator, and they were mostly old, white, decrepit, upscale Latinas and Latinos who absolutely resented this new guy coming in making all that noise. They didn't realize I was doing a complete tear-down jackhammer remodel. So they tried to screw with me. And every day there were just sacks and sacks of debris and pieces of cement, busted tile, old countertops, etc., overflowing out of the garbage dumpsters. The complaints listed that too. And I knew every day when I got in and out of that elevator and someone else got in with me, there was dead silence. Knowing that person was likely one of the people that signed those petitions to sick the cops in the municipality on me. Now remember, when the first cops came and gave me the cease and desist order, I absolutely had to call a lawyer because if I didn't cease and desist, they'd nail me for that too. And I was thinking, how can I stop the project now? It's not done. It was kind of like a bad dream in fantasy land. So anyway, the moment I finished that project, I was dead set on selling it. And for the next couple months, I lived there on and off for a little while, showed it to a lot of realtors. And once it hit the market, it sold in 1 week. Now, I didn't lose money on it. I actually made a little bit, but for the grief, it was absolutely not worth it. Basically, I lost more than 6 months of my life that I'll never be able to get back again. And even now, a year or so later, it bothers me a bit when I think about it because it was the kind of penthouse people dream of owning. Perfect location, secure, beautiful scenery. A first-class remodeling job. All the doors, rainforest hardwood, I like that. All high-end fixtures, ultra-modern kitchen, beautiful furnishings, 30 solar panels powering the thing so it was totally off the grid. Oh, and by the way, the Junta Directiva, the committee, didn't like that either. So they filed a complaint with the municipality, but haha, they've got laws in Latin American countries to encourage solar power wherever you can put it. So the judge threw that one out in a New York minute. That said, in the end, what's the moral of that story? Well, next time I decide to buy an apartment or penthouse in a residential tower, I will definitely spend some time checking out the residents to make sure they're just not a bunch of stiffs using the place as a luxury nursing home. All right, we're getting towards the end now. I have one last announcement. Remember, my March 2023 Expat Insider Seminar is launching in about a month. You can still get on board, and remember, you'll be drinking from the fire hose. Just go to expatplanb.com for all the info and sign-up details. By the way, isn't it funny? For this particular seminar, I've got more people who are repeat offenders signed up than first-time attendees. Now, that speaks volumes, doesn't it?
You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.